Well, good evening. Good to be back with you this evening. Good to open up the Bible with you and study therein. We were talking last Sunday night about premillennialism, which encompasses a lot of different ideas. The first being that there's going to be an end times, and we talked about last week a premillennialistic thought of there are signs, earthquakes, and pestilences, and wars, different things that are going to go on, and we identified that was totally taken out of the original context of the Bible, and that's not at all what Jesus was talking about when he mentioned those very things. But after the signs of the end times in premillennialism comes the very next thing that will happen after the signs of end times, according to a premillennialist, is something called the rapture, which is very popular, extremely popular today. It certainly hasn't always been that way, but today it is very popular. Everyone knows a little bit about the rapture. They might not know exactly what it all entails, but they know about it. They might not know the scriptures used to confirm concepts of the rapture, but that's okay because that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at the scriptures that are commonly used to confirm that there is a rapture, and we're going to do some checks and balances and see if all of that is accurate. So there are a couple of places where the concept of the rapture has been taken from. One of those places is Matthew 24. Now, last week we spent all Sunday night in Matthew 24. But in Matthew 24, verse 40, Jesus said, "Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, the other left." All right, so this is an interesting text, isn't it? Because if you read it only as we read it, which we read it without any scope of context, period. When you look at it without any context, you don't have any idea. I mean, we have no idea what Jesus is talking about in conversation. I mean, we have hopped right into the very middle of some sort of conversation, and he's talking about two men being in the field, one taken, the other left. I mean, what is he dealing with? Well, some say he's talking about a rapture. Well, just out of context like that, I mean, there's nothing to suggest that this is referring to one taken in a rapture. This could be two men in a field, and the military takes them over, and one is taken captive, and the other is left behind. I mean, we could talk about all different kinds of scenarios. The point I'm trying to make is, without the context, this is nothing. It means absolutely nothing to us without the context. Now, certainly Jesus meant something by it, but we have got to know the context before we can talk about this text. We can't just sit here and dream something up. And so that's what we're going to do a little bit later on, is we're going to come back to this verse and talk about this. But a little bit more on this concept of the rapture. Some of you are probably familiar with the name Hal Lindsey, who is really a guy several decades ago who really popularized this concept of a rapture. I think before his time, it certainly wasn't nearly as popular a doctrine as it was. And he wrote several books, but one of them was called The Late Great Planet Earth. And he describes this rapture. He illustrates this rapture. He says, "There I was driving down the highway, and all of a sudden, the place went crazy. Cars going in all directions, and not one of them had a driver. I mean, it was wild. I think we've got an invasion from outer space." So he's just trying to give us a picture, an illustration of what this rapture would be like. And it would be incredibly chaotic. I mean, the cars would be driving, and all of a sudden they don't have drivers. And you've probably seen the bumper sticker, you know. In case of rapture, this car will be unmanned. Just humorous bumper stickers out there that say different things like that. And, you know, that's what he's talking about. In another place in the same book, Hal Lindsey says, it was puzzling, very puzzling. I was teaching my course in the philosophy of religion when all of a sudden three of my students vanished. They simply vanished. They were quite argumentative, always trying to prove their point from the Bible. No great loss to the class. However, I do find this disappearance very difficult to explain. So, you know, he's illustrating again another circumstance of this is what will happen. This is what it will be like when this rapture comes. People are just going to be vanishing no matter where they are. Now, what is concerning to me, first and foremost, is that the rapture, the doctrine of the rapture, has really no historical footprint. It's not an ancient landmark. All right, it's not ancient. It's not an ancient concept whatsoever. You can look, you know, way back, you know, several hundred years. You can even go back 1,000 years and 2,000 years, and you won't be able to find this doctrine. Now that concerns me that if this was in the Bible, that it would be, you think it would be taught. It would be taught in various ways and at least in various circles, but it wasn't. And so that leads me to raise the question to you and to myself of where did this idea come from? I can't find it really in the history books. Not any further than, you know, just a couple hundred years ago. So where did it come from? Well, the earliest date that has been found for the first teaching of a concept of a rapture was done in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the year was 1788, and the man's name was Morgan Edwards. And this is the first written record occurrence of someone teaching a concept like a rapture. Now, this all came out because there was a man named John Bray, and he was a Baptist preacher, and he was really struggling to find any historical grounding, footing for the rapture. And so he created this contest by which he was giving a cash reward for the person that could find documentation of the earliest documentation of teachings of the rapture. And so he was struggling in that himself, and he was trying to find it. And the information I have up here on the board is the earliest that could be found. And this is what John Bray said after the study was concluded. He said, "It was mighty embarrassing to me as a Baptist to learn that now I cannot trace this teaching to anyone further back than a Baptist leader, and here in America at that." So I think we can all see why this would be concerning. This certainly isn't a doctrine that we should just readily accept, put it in our pocket, and walk out of here fine and dandy. There are some great concerns here as to where this doctrine came from and why it was never preached until being here in America in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I want us to open our Bibles. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. There are really two key verses that have been used since the late 1700s to teach this concept of a rapture, of people vanishing. And the one is what we've already looked at in Matthew 24. 2 men at the mill, 1 taken, the other left. Or 2 men out in the field, rather. 1 taken, the other left. And the other is this here in 1 Thessalonians 4. And I want to read this with you in verse 13. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with Him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. For the Lord Himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with Him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. So, in the context, the Thessalonian brethren were struggling with this idea of a resurrection and this final day, and this day in which all who are righteous and all who live by faith in the Son of God would be collected together and they would live with the Lord, be with the Lord, and it would be that way for all eternity. Thessalonians didn't actually know that was gonna happen. What a sad thought. So Paul is trying to teach them of these very important truths that we rest a lot of hope on as Christians, this hope of this resurrection. Now, within this text, we see that as Paul is talking about individuals being resurrected, as well as individuals who are alive in verse 17, he talks about we who are alive and remain. That is, those who didn't die, and the Christ has come now, but they haven't died yet, that they also, he says, would be caught up together with them, that is, with the resurrected, so those who had died and were resurrected, they will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Now, if you notice in the English, and most English translations are pretty similar, in verse 17 he says, "We who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them." Now this word caught up, or words in English, is one Greek word, harpazo. And it literally means to seize by force. So he says, we who are alive and remain shall be caught up. We will be seized by force, brought up into the clouds, and we will meet the Lord in the air, is the point that he's saying. Now, if you look at the Latin version of the Bible, the Latin word that is used instead of the Greek word harpazo, the Latin word is raptura. And that Latin word means to carry off by force. Essentially the exact same meaning as the Greek word. It is a proper translation of the word. But what we have seen now is a transliteration into English from the Latin word raptura, which means to carry off by force. And we now have the English word rapture, which essentially still carries that same meaning of you know, being carried off by force. Well, let's consider what Paul is saying to the Thessalonians, because he is indeed talking about being carried off, carried away by force. But does this scene that Paul is illustrating in the text, does this fit the doctrine of the rapture? Well, the first thing I think we should consider is that the rapture, by the doctrine by definition, is a secret and a mysterious a seizure of individuals by force. And is that what we see illustrated here by Paul in the text? In verse 16, Paul says, "For the Lord Himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first, and we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." So, what Paul is illustrating is how this is all going to begin, how it will all come about, is number one, there will be the Lord Himself descending from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God. So we have the Lord Himself shouting out, crying out. We have the trumpet of God blasting. In my mind, I don't see anything silent about this. This is a situation that is very loud. This is a situation that everyone's going to hear and understand this. This is the shouting of God Himself from heaven and the trumpet. But Hal Lindsey, again, going back to him, because he's kind of an authority on this concept of the rapture, he said that the rapture is a mystery. It's a secret. He says when the living believers are taken out, the world is going to be mystified. And so they take this concept of the rapture out of verse 17 of 1 Thessalonians 4, where it talks about those who are alive and remain being caught up to meet the Lord in the air. And but he says that this is all going to be a mystery. It's all going to be secretive. But when I read 1 Thessalonians 4, I see a very public situation that's going on. I see a very universal situation going on with a great deal of noise, a great deal of joy on the parts of the believers, but a great deal of fear on the part of the world. So I think some have objected to 1 Thessalonians 4 because he never talks about the wicked. And that's the main thrust of the rapture, is it's only for the righteous. So what happens to the wicked? They're never mentioned. And that's absolutely true. In 1 Thessalonians 4, they are never mentioned. Never mentioned about rising from the dead, never mentioned about being judged, or anything like that. But we need to remind ourselves that of what we're reading. We are reading a letter written to someone else, someone who is sorrowful over the death of their own brethren because they had not yet been taught that their brethren would be resurrected. That's the context. Paul has no intention of breaking down for them a perfect order and list and detail of everything that's going to happen on the day of judgment. That's not his purpose at all. And we saw how he began, right? We saw how he began in the context. He says, I want to write these things to you because I don't want you to be sorrowful. I don't want you to be sorrowful about the loss of your brethren, because guess what? The Lord's going to shout and your brethren are going to raise. And you're going to be caught up with them in the air, and you're going to be with them. See, that's the point of the context. Not once does he stop and say, all right, I'm going to give you guys all the details. I'm not going to leave anything out. And it's only the right. No, he only talks about the righteous because this is the concern of the Thessalonians. Where's their brethren? Where's their brethren who they are putting in the grave? That's the point of the text. If we want to see other scriptures on this, we can see other scriptures where the dead rise, where the wicked dead rise with the righteous. And we will see that before this lesson closes. But let's break down premillennialism a little bit more for those who are not so much familiar with it. And I know it can be confusing. So what happens in the end times, according to premillennialism, is the first thing is the rapture. The rapture is when righteous who are on the earth they vanish. They're taken up to be with the Lord. And then at the exact same time as well, you have all the righteous dead resurrected. So all the wicked dead remain in the grave, according to premillennialism. They all remain. Only the righteous dead are resurrected, and the righteous who are alive are raptured, and they're all with the Lord, and they're with Him for only 7 years. And so once they're all off this planet, what will happen next will be a great tribulation, and it will last for a course of 7 days. That's taken out of from the book of Daniel. Now, after this tribulation of, I said 7 days, I'm sorry, I meant 7 years. 7 years. And after these 7 years, the Christ will come back. So this would be His third coming. So His first coming was in the first century. His second coming was in the rapture, and now His third coming is on the earth. So in now this third coming, He comes back to the earth. He rests the soles of His feet on the soil of the earth, and He will live here for 1,000 years. And guess what? He brings all the people back with Him. All those who were raptured, all the righteous who were resurrected, they're all coming back. Everybody comes back. And you still have the wicked there on the earth as well. And Christ is going to come. He's going to set up a throne in the literal city of David in Jerusalem. And He will be an earthly king for exactly 1,000 years. That concept is we're not talking about today because we're talking about the rapture, but that concept is taken out of context from the book of Revelation. After the 1,000-year reign of Christ, the wicked who have been in the grave for all this time, they are finally resurrected, and here comes the judgment. So, I want us to consider this a little bit. The first thing that happens in premillennialism is that the righteous are resurrected. The last thing that happens in premillennialism is that the wicked are resurrected, and then you have the day of judgment. Now, do the math in your head. How many years span between the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked? 1,007 years. 1,007 years. I want you to think about that. Remember that figure. And I want us to look at John chapter 5 and verse 28, where Jesus said, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear His voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." Premillennialism says that the resurrection between the righteous and the wicked spans the course of 1,007 years total. Jesus said, "The hour is coming when all who are in their graves will hear His voice. Those who have done good will be raised unto eternal life, resurrection of life. Those who have done evil, to the resurrection of condemnation." The hour, not 107, I'm really messing my figures up this evening. Not 1,007 years later, would they be raised to condemnation, but the same hour. So in the same span of time, the same period of time, that's what Jesus said. Now remember, Jesus also said, all who are in their graves will hear His voice and come forth. Remember what we learned from Paul from 1 Thessalonians 4:16, when he said, the Lord Himself will descend from heaven with a shout. All who are in their graves will hear His voice. And so this shout is not just heard by the righteous. It's heard by everyone. It's heard in the grave. It's heard in the grave of the righteous. It's heard in the grave of the condemned and the wicked. And at the very same hour, the righteous will be raised unto eternal life. And at the very same hour, the wicked will be raised to condemnation and everlasting hell. So this is what we're seeing. We're seeing the harmony of the biblical record about the resurrection of the dead. If you remember back, if you still have 1 Thessalonians 4 open, if you remember back what verse 17 said, when he said that we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with Him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. And thus, I know the word thus doesn't look like it means a whole lot, but I did look it up. I looked it up in the Greek. And it literally means in this manner. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. Uh-oh. See, that's another problem. Let me go back here to our previous slide. What we have here in premillennialism is the rapture, which is a concept taken from 1 Thessalonians 4. But 1 Thessalonians 4 says, we're going up into the air, and in that manner, we will always be with the Lord. But premillennialism says, no, in 7 years, only 7 years you'll be with the Lord in that manner. Then you're all coming back down. You won't be in the heavens with Him all the time. You will come back down to earth for 1,000 years. So what we have here is, again, another contradiction of Scripture when Paul says, we're going up into the air, we're going into the heavens, and in that manner, we will always be with the Lord. So again, we see more contradiction. Now, I want us to look back at Matthew chapter 24. This is where we begin our lesson. But I thought it'd be best for us to look at 1 Thessalonians, to look at scriptures like John 5, and to get a good grasp on this concept of the last day and this resurrection day and this day of judgment, which Jesus said, it's all the same day, and it's all the same hour. Everyone will be raised. They'll be raised unto judgment. Did not the writer of Hebrews say, it is appointed unto a man to die once, and after that, the judgment? That's what the Bible writer said. It's appointed for man to die once, then after that, the judgment. Okay, now, Matthew 24 and verse 40. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left. What does he mean by that? Well, one thing I can tell you is if you take that out of context, you still can't get the rapture out of it. Because, you can't prove it. There's no way to prove that this is talking about some sort of rapture where one guy just vanishes one day and the other is left. He doesn't say vanish. He doesn't give details that one's going to be caught up into the heavens. No, it just says one's taken. So we still don't know. The two verses themselves do not give us the resources to be able to understand what's being said. But what will help us understand is the context. Now, we spent a lot of time in Matthew 24 last Sunday evening. We talked about the destruction of Jerusalem. Remember in the beginning of the text, the apostles asked Jesus, when will this great temple in Jerusalem be destroyed? Jesus said, it'll be in your generation. And he said, if you see the abominable army of Rome coming towards Judea, he said, you drop everything that you're doing and you get out of there. If you look in verse 34, if you back up to verse 34, remember, as he's been talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, he said, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. There is that very important time stamp that we talked about last week. This generation will by no means pass away till everything that he has already talked about thus far would take place. Now in verse 35, he begins and says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. Remember, the apostles asked him several questions. They said, when will this temple be destroyed? And that's what he's been spending all his time talking about. Then they ask him, what would be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? Well, Jesus answered the first question, but he hasn't talked about their next questions, has he? Well, I believe he's going to start to. Because they asked him, what about the end? What about the end? And what about your coming? And what signs do you have for your coming? What warning do we have? Well, he begins to talk in verse 35 about heaven and earth passing away. In verse 36, he says, but of that day, in context, the day that heaven and earth would pass away, but of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. So, the apostles asked for a sign. A sign of His coming. Jesus' response is, I'm sorry, but there's not going to be one. There won't be a single sign. There will be no warning whatsoever. But He describes the day that would turn into the day of judgment. He describes it as the days of Noah. When people were, as He says, eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, he says, until the day that Noah entered the ark. No real warning, in a sense anyway. We're leaving one thing out. There is the word of warning. But that's all there is. With Noah, the scriptures teach, he was a preacher of righteousness. He gave the word of warning. But the people continued on. We give the word of warning that the time is coming in which there will be a day of judgment. Are we ready? Are you ready? We give that word. But as far as signs are concerned, there is none. There is absolutely none. He says it's just going to be like the days of Noah. Life's going to continue on. Look at these people. They're eating, they're drinking, they're marrying and giving in marriage. Why are they marrying? Why are they being given in marriage? Because people are still looking for a future. They're still expecting that there's going to be a tomorrow when there's not. No warning whatsoever. That's why they're still getting married. because they still think there's going to be a future. Now, in verse 39, he says, they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. We don't know very much about those days. But Jesus just told us something about those days. That the people did not know until they were being blasted by the flood and carried off to their death. So in verse 40, he says, then two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know the hour your Lord is coming. All right, following the context, what is he dealing with? He's describing the day that would turn into the day of judgment. 2 men at the mill. It's an everyday. It's an everyday work day. 2 men in the field. I keep saying 2 men at the mill. I don't know why. 2 men in the field, 2 women at the mill. It's an everyday work day. That's what we're to take out of this understanding. Well, that's not all that we're to take. Because he makes reference to one being taken, the other being left. Now, he doesn't just stop here. He's going to keep talking about this day. He's going to give several parables, several examples. He's going to illustrate this day very well throughout the text. And he's going to continue for quite a long time. In fact, when you go to chapter 25, you think he's done, but no, he's not. He's not done at all. Chapter 25 is a chapter break, but it's not a break in his words. He is continuing to push forward and talk about this day that would be the last. So what does he mean specifically by one taken and the other left? Well, all you have to do is give him a little bit of time and he'll come back to it, right? He'll come back to it and he'll talk to you about it. And that's what he does here in chapter 25. He explains himself. He explains what he means by one is taken, the other left. But he does it in the form of a parable. So I'm going to stop right here before I say that. And I'm going to say this one thing. You're going to come across this one day. About 2 men being in the field, one taken, the other left. Maybe in a conversation with somebody. Maybe you're reading through your Bible and there you stumble upon that once again. And you're going to say, I know the preacher preached on this, but I can't remember what he said. I can't remember what he said about that. And it's going to really irritate you because you were here. You know, and you saw it, and you understood it, and now you forgot, because that's what we do, is we forget. So, if you forget everything in this lesson, try your hardest to remember this one thing. When you stumble upon this text in Matthew 24, jump over to the same discourse in chapter 25 and begin reading as the start of chapter 25. Because he explains himself. He says in verse 1, then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard. Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. And the wise answered, saying, no, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with them to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said to them, assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour which the Son of Man is coming.
So, you see the conclusion? You see his conclusion of that parable? Watch therefore, for you do not know the day or the hour when the Son of Man's coming. Isn't that the exact same, basically the exact same words that he gave when he talked about the two men in the field? Look back in 24, after he talked about the two men and the two women, in verse 44 he said, therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. He says, be ready. Chapter 25, he says, watch, because you don't know. So what happened in this account? You have 10 virgins with lamps. Five of them had enough oil in their lamps to keep the lamp burning. The other five were foolish, according to Jesus. They didn't keep enough oil in their lamps. Their lamps went out. They weren't ready to meet the bridegroom. They went out. They went and they tried to buy oil. Now remember, this is all just an illustration to teach a spiritual truth. It's not that here the Lord comes. Do I have time to go jump, jump in the water and get baptized? That's not going to happen. We're out of luck. We're out of chances. We had every day of our life to make the proper choices. We had every breath was a chance for us to do what is right and to make our life right with God. And so that's not what he's teaching. What he is teaching is what he meant by two men in the field, one taken, the other left. Two women in the mill, one taken, the other left. Notice that, again, he divides in the parable, he divides 50-50. Just as we saw the 50-50 in chapter 24, one taken, the other left. Here we have, in his next illustration, five taken and five left, right? Notice that five are taken. Taken where? They're taken into the feast. They're taken into the wedding. Did you see that? Verse 10. It says, chapter 25, verse 10. While they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Okay? So, this is his illustration of the five wives, but we can relate this back to chapter 24 of the one man taken and the other left. Now notice what happens to the other five in chapter 25. In verse 11 it says, afterward, the other virgins came also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, surely I say to you, I do not know you. So, in relationship to chapter 24, two men are in the field. Why are they in the field? Because it's everyday life. It's the middle of their work week. It is a normal day, and all of a sudden, judgment day. One's taken, the other's left. How did he illustrate judgment day in chapter 25? One's taken. Taken where? Taken into the feast. Taken into the celebration of the Lord. The other is left. Left where? Well, you notice how the bridegroom shut the door? The wise came in, and he shuts the door. So one says, where are they left? People automatically think, oh, they're left on the earth. And that's not the point. They are left out. They are left out. Two men are in the field. One is taken into the joy of his Lord. The other is left behind the door, banging and pleading. That's what the Lord means. After all, we know from the context that the one who is left was not left on earth, was he? And that's a big mistake of premillennialism. They think one's raptured up and the other is left on the earth. There's going to be a great tribulation for 7 years. No, because remember the context? The context is about the coming of the Lord, and the coming of the Lord is in the same occasion as the passing away of heaven and earth. Do you see that in verse 35? Heaven and earth will pass away. Verse 36, but of that day no one knows. what day? The day that heaven and earth will pass away. So, if two men are in the field, one's taken, the other's left, we can deduce that that he who is left is left somewhere, but we know for a fact he's not left on earth, because earth is gone. Earth has passed away. Remember what we looked at also last week in 2 Peter 3, verse 10, when he said, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with a fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." So they won't be left here. They can't, because here will not exist anymore. So, you know, it's frustrating to me that sometimes we have to go through this. I understand the need to defend the truth, but it is frustrating sometimes because sometimes I just want to look at the simple truths of Christ and see what he has to say in the beautiful harmony of its original context. And the words are striking. Instead of thinking of concepts of a rapture, you know, our mind should be going to an examination of our life. We don't want to be left out. We don't want to be left behind the doors. We don't want to be the one banging on it saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." That's what we really need to get out of that context. Not spend all the time having to defend the truth against a false doctrine. Nevertheless, that is the situation that we are in sometimes, as it was tonight. But I do appreciate your attention this evening. If you have any further questions or comments, please let me know, and we'll deal with them. As for tonight, if there is anyone who does not want to be left out, and they know in their conscience that, yeah, if the Lord came in the next hour, I would be the one banging on the door, we need to make some changes. You know you need to make some changes. You just need to come forward and let us know so we can help you. We can help you make those changes. So if that describes your state, then let us know so that we can help you come into salvation. While together we stand and sing.
Is our